serious attack upon the independence of the states. The rights awarded to the federal government for purposes of obvious national importance are definite and easily comprehensible. But those with which this last clause invests it are not either clearly appreciable or accurately defined. For there are vast numbers of political laws which influence the existence of obligations of contracts, which may thus furnish an easy pretext for the aggressions of the central authority. Procedure of the Federal Courts. I have shown what the privileges of the federal courts are, and it is no less important to point out the manner in which they are exercised. The irresistible authority of justice in countries in which the sovereignty is undivided is derived from the fact that the tribunals of those countries represent the entire nation at issue, with the individual against whom their decree is directed, and the idea of power is thus introduced to corroborate the idea of right. But this is not always the case in countries in which the sovereignty is divided. In them, the judicial power is more frequently opposed to a fraction of the nation and to an isolated individual, and its moral authority and physical strength are consequently diminished. In federal states, the power of the judge is naturally decreased, and that of the justiciable parties is augmented. The aim of the legislator in confederate states ought therefore to be to render the position of the courts of justice analogous to that which they occupy in countries where the sovereignty is undivided. In other words, his efforts ought constantly to tend to maintain the judicial power of the confederation as the representative of the nation, and the justiciable party as the representative of an individual interest. Every government, whatever may be its constitution, requires the means of constraining its subjects to discharge their obligations and of protecting its privileges from their assaults. As far as the direct action of the government on the community is concerned, the Constitution of the United States contrived, by a master stroke of policy, that the federal courts, acting in the name of the laws, should only take cognizance of parties in an individual capacity. For, as it had been declared that the Union consisted of one and the same people within the limits laid down by the Constitution, the inference was that the government created by this Constitution and acting within these limits was invested with all the privileges of a national government, one of the principal of which is the right of transmitting its injunctions directly to the private citizen. When, for instance, the Union votes an impost, it does not apply to the states for the levying of it, but to every American citizen in proportion to his assessment. The Supreme Court, which is empowered to enforce the execution of this law of the Union, exerts its influence not upon a refractory state, but upon the private taxpayer. And, like the judicial power of other nations, it is opposed to the person of an individual. It is to be observed that the Union chose its own antagonist, and as that antagonist is feeble, he is naturally worsted. But the difficulty increases when the proceedings are not brought forward by, but against, the Union. The Constitution recognizes the legislative power of the states, and a law so enacted may impair the privileges of the Union, in which case a collision is unavoidable between that body and the state which has passed the law, and it only remains to select the least dangerous remedy, which is very clearly deductible from the general principles I have before established. It may be conceived that, in the case under consideration, the Union might have used the state before a federal court, which would have annulled the act, and by this means it would have adopted a natural course of proceeding. But the judicial power would have been placed in open hostility to the state, and it was desirable to avoid this predicament as much as possible. The Americans hold that it is nearly impossible that a new law should not impair the interests of some private individual by its provisions. These private interests are assumed by the American legislators as the ground of attack against such measures as may be prejudicial to the Union, and it is to these cases that the protection of the Supreme Court is extended. Suppose a state vends a certain portion of its territory to a company, and that a year afterwards it passes a law by which the territory is otherwise disposed of, and that clause of the Constitution which prohibits laws impairing the obligation of contracts violated. When the purchaser under the Second Act appears to take possession, the possessor under the First Act brings his action before the tribunals of the Union, and causes the title of the claimant to be pronounced null and void. Thus, in point of fact, the judicial power of the union is contesting the claims of the sovereignty of a state, but it only acts indirectly and upon a special application of detail. It attacks the law in its consequences, not in its principle, and it rather weakens than destroys it. The last hypothesis that remained was that each state formed a corporation enjoying a separate existence and distinct civil rights, and that it could therefore sue or be sued before a tribunal. Thus, a state could bring an action against another state. In this instance, the union was not called upon to contest a provincial law, but to try a suit in which a state was a party. This suit was perfectly similar to any other cause, except that the quality of the parties was different. And here the danger pointed out at the beginning of this chapter exists with less chance of being avoided. The inherent disadvantage of the very essence of federal constitutions is that they engender parties in the bosom of the nation which present powerful obstacles to the free course of justice. High rank of the Supreme Court amongst the great powers of state. When we have successively examined in detail the organization of the Supreme Court and the entire prerogatives which it exercises, we shall readily admit that a more imposing judicial power was never constituted by any people. The Supreme Court is placed at the head of all known tribunals, both by the nature of its rights and the class of justiciable parties which it controls. In all the civilized countries of Europe, the government has always shown the greatest repugnance to allow the cases to which it was itself a party to be decided by the ordinary course of justice. This repugnance naturally attains its utmost height in an absolute government. And, on the other hand, the privileges of the courts of justice are extended with the increasing liberties of the people. But no European nation has at present held that all judicial controversies, without regard to their origin, can be decided by the judges of common law. In America, this theory has been actually put in practice, and the Supreme Court of the United States is the sole tribunal of the nation. Its power extends to all the cases arising under laws and treaties made by the executive and legislative authorities, to all cases of admiralty and maritime jurisdiction, and in general to all points which affect the law of nations. It may even be affirmed that, although its constitution is essentially judicial, its prerogatives are almost entirely political. Its sole object is to enforce the execution of the laws of the Union. And the Union only regulates the regulations of the government with the citizens and of the nation with foreign powers. The relations of citizens amongst themselves are almost exclusively regulated by the sovereignty of the states. A second and still greater cause of the preponderance of this court may be adduced. In the nations of Europe, the courts of justice are only called upon to try the controversies of private individuals, but the Supreme Court of the United States summons sovereign powers to its bar. When the clerk of the court advances on the steps of the tribunal and simply says, "The state of New York versus the state of Ohio," it is impossible not to feel that the court which he addresses is no ordinary body. And when it is recollected that one of these parties represents 1 million and the other 2 millions of men, one is struck by the responsibility of the 7 judges whose decision is about to satisfy or to disappoint so large a number of their fellow citizens. The peace, the prosperity, and the very existence of the Union are vested in the hands of the 7 judges. Without their active cooperation, the Constitution would be a dead letter. The executive appeals to them for assistance against the encroachments of the legislative powers. The legislature demands their protection from the designs of the executive. They defend the Union from the disobedience of the states from the exaggerated claims of the Union, the public interest against the interests of private citizens, and the conservative spirit of order against the fleeting innovations of democracy. Their power is enormous, but it is clothed in the authority of public opinion. They are the all-powerful guardians of a people which respects law, but they would be impotent against popular neglect or popular contempt. The force of public opinion is the most intractable of agents, because its exact limits cannot be defined, and it is not less dangerous to exceed and to remain below the boundary prescribed. The federal judges must not only be good citizens and men possessed of that information and integrity which are indispensable to magistrates, but they must be statesmen, politicians not unread in the signs of the times, not afraid to brave the obstacles which can be subdued, nor slow to turn aside such encroaching elements as may threaten the supremacy of the Union and the obedience which is due to the laws. The President, who exercises a limited power, may err without causing great mischief in the state. Congress may decide amiss without destroying the Union, because the electoral body in which Congress originates may cause it to retract its decision by changing its members. But if the Supreme Court is ever composed of imprudent men or bad citizens, the Union may be plunged into anarchy or civil war. The real cause of this danger, however, does not lie in the constitution of the tribunal, but in the very nature of federal governments. We have observed that in Confederate peoples it is especially necessary to consolidate the judicial authority, because in no other nations do those independent persons who are able to cope with the social body exist in greater power or in a better condition to resist the physical strength of the government. But the more a power requires to be strengthened, the more extensive and independent it must be made, and the dangers which its abuse may create are heightened by its independence and its strength. The source of the evil is not, therefore, in the constitution of the power, but in the constitution of those states which render its existence necessary. In what respects the federal constitution is superior to that of the states? The federal constitution differs essentially from that of the states in the ends which it is intended to accomplish, but in the means by which these ends are promoted, a greater analogy exists between them. The objects of the governments are different, but their forms are the same, and in this special point of view there is some advantage in comparing them together. I am of opinion that the federal constitution is superior to all the constitutions of the states for several reasons. The present constitution of the Union was formed at a later period than those of the majority of the states, and it may have derived some ameliorations from past experience. But we shall be led to acknowledge that this is only a secondary cause of its superiority. When we recollect that 11 new states have been added to the American Confederation since the promulgation of the Federal Constitution, and that these new republics have always rather exaggerated than avoided the defects which existed in the former constitutions. The chief cause of the superiority of the Federal Constitution lay in the character of the legislators who composed it. At the time when it was formed, the dangers of the Confederation were imminent, and its ruin seemed inevitable. In this extremity, the people chose the men who most deserved the esteem rather than those who had gained the affections of the country. I have already observed that, distinguished as most all the legislators of the Union were for their intelligence, they were still more so for their patriotism. They had all been nurtured at a time when the spirit of liberty was braced by a continual struggle against a powerful and predominant authority. When the contest was terminated, whilst the excited passions of the populace persisted in warring with dangers which had ceased to threaten them, these men stopped short in their career. They cast a calmer and more penetrating look upon the country which was now their own. They perceived that the War of Independence was definitely ended, and that the only dangers which America had to fear were those which might result from the abuse of the freedom she had won. They had the courage to say what they believed to be true, because they were animated by a warm and sincere love of liberty, and they ventured to propose restrictions because they were resolutely opposed to destruction. Author's note: at this time, Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the principal founders of the Constitution, ventured to express the following sentiments in The Federalist, Number 71. There are some who would be inclined to regard the servile pliancy of the executive to a prevailing current, either in the community or in the legislature, as its best recommendation. But such men entertain very crude notions, as well of the purposes for which government was instituted as of the true means by which the public happiness may be promoted. The Republican principle demands that the deliberative sense of the community should govern the conduct of those to whom they entrust the management of their affairs. but it does not require an unqualified complaisance to every sudden breeze of passion or to every transient impulse which the people may receive from the arts of men who flatter their prejudices to betray their interests. It is a just observation that the people commonly intend the public good. This often applies to their very errors. But their good sense would despise the adulator who should pretend that they always reason right about the means of promoting it. They know from experience that they sometimes err, and the wonder is that they so seldom err as they do, beset as they continually are, by the wiles of parasites and sycophants, by the snares of the ambitious, the avaricious, the desperate, by the artifices of men who possess their confidence more than they deserve it, and of those who seek to possess rather than to deserve it. When occasions present themselves in which the interests of the people are at variance with their inclinations, it is the duty of persons whom they have appointed to be the guardians of those interests to withstand the temporary delusion in order to give them time and opportunity for more cool and sedate reflection. Instances might be cited in which a conduct of this kind has saved the people from very fatal consequences of their own mistakes and has procured lasting monuments of their gratitude to the men who had courage and magnanimity enough to serve them at the peril of their displeasure. The greater number of the constitutions of the states assign 1 year for the duration of the House of Representatives and 2 years for that of the Senate, so that members of the legislative body are constantly and narrowly tied down by the slightest desires of their constituents. The legislators of the Union were of opinion that this excessive dependence of the legislature tended to alter the nature of the main consequences of the representative system, since it vested the source, not only of authority, but of government, in the people. They increased the length of time for which the representatives were returned in order to give them freer scope for the exercise of their own judgment. The federal constitution, as well as the constitutions of the different states, divided the legislative body into two branches. But in the states, these two branches were composed of the same elements and elected in the same manner. The consequence was that the passions and inclinations of the populace were as rapidly and as energetically represented in one chamber as in the other, and that laws were made with all the characteristics of violence and precipitation. By the federal constitution, the two houses originate in like manner in the choice of the people. But the conditions of eligibility and the mode of election were changed, to the end that, if, as is the case in certain nations, one branch of the legislature represents the same interests as the other, it may at least represent a superior degree of intelligence and discretion. A mature age was made one of the conditions of the senatorial dignity, and the upper house was chosen by an elected assembly of a limited number of members. To concentrate the whole social force in the hands of the legislative body is the natural tendency of democracies. For as this is the power which emanates the most directly from the people, it is made to participate most fully in the preponderating authority of the multitude, and it is naturally led to monopolize every species of influence. This concentration is at once prejudicial to a well-conducted administration and favorable to the despotism of the majority. The legislators of the states frequently yielded to these democratic propensities, which were invariably and courageously resisted by the founders of the Union. In the states, the executive power is vested in the hands of a magistrate, who is apparently placed upon a level with the legislature, but who is in reality nothing more than the blind agent and the passive instrument of its decisions. He can derive no influence from the duration of his functions, which terminate with the revolving year, or from the exercise of prerogatives which can scarcely be said to exist. The legislature can condemn him to inaction by entrusting the execution of the laws to special committees of its own members, and can annul his temporary dignity by depriving him of his salary. The federal constitution vests all the privileges and all the responsibility of the executive power in a single individual. The duration of the presidency is fixed at 4 years. The salary of the individual who fills that office cannot be altered during the term of his functions. He is protected by a body of official dependents and armed with a suspensive veto. In short, every effort was made to confer a strong and independent position upon the executive authority within the limits which had been prescribed to it. In the constitutions of all the states, the judicial power is that which remains the most independent of the legislative authority. Nevertheless, in all the states, the legislature has reserved to itself the right of regulating the emoluments of the judges, a practice which necessarily subjects these magistrates to its immediate influence. In some states, the judges are only temporarily appointed, which deprives them of a great portion of their power and their freedom. In others, the legislative and judicial powers are entirely confounded. Thus, the Senate of New York, for instance, constitutes in certain cases the superior court of the state. The federal constitution, on the other hand, carefully separates the judicial authority from all external influences, and it provides for the independence of the judges by declaring that their salary shall not be altered, and that their functions shall be inalienable. The practical consequences of these different systems may easily be perceived. An attentive observer will soon remark that the business of the Union is incomparably better conducted than that of any individual state. The conduct of the federal government is more fair and more temperate than that of the states. Its designs are more fraught with wisdom. Its projects are more durable and more skillfully combined. Its measures are put into execution with more vigor and consistency. I recapitulate the substance of this chapter in a few words. The existence of democracies is threatened by two dangers, namely, the complete subjection of the legislative body to the caprices of the electoral body, and the concentration of all powers of the government in the legislative authority. The growth of these evils has been encouraged by the policy of the legislators of the states, but it has been resisted by the legislators of the Union by every means which lay within their control. Characteristics which distinguish the Federal Constitution of the United States of America from all other federal constitutions. The United States of America do not afford either the first or the only instance of confederate states, several of which have existed in modern Europe without adverting to those of antiquity. Switzerland, the Germanic Empire, and the Republic of the United Provinces either have been or still are confederations. In studying the constitutions of these different countries, the politician is surprised to observe that the powers with which they invested the federal government are nearly identical with the privileges awarded by the American Constitution to the government of the United States. They confer upon the central power the same rights of making peace and war, of raising money and troops, and of providing for the general exigencies and the common interests of the nation. Nevertheless, the federal government of these different peoples has always been as remarkable for its weakness and inefficiency as that of the Union is for its vigorous and enterprising spirit. Again, the first American Confederation perished through the excessive weakness of its government. And this weak government was, notwithstanding, in possession of rights even more extensive than those of the federal government of the present day. But the more recent Constitution of the United States contains certain principles which exercise a most important influence, although they do not at once strike the observer. This Constitution, which may at first sight be confounded with the federal constitutions which preceded it, rests upon a novel theory, which may be considered as a great invention in modern political science. In all the confederations which had been formed before the American Constitution of 1789, the Allied states agreed to obey the injunctions of a federal government, but they reserved to themselves the right of ordaining and enforcing the execution of the laws of the Union. The American states, which combined in 1789, agreed that the federal government should not only dictate the laws, but that it should execute its own enactments. In both cases, the right is the same, but the exercise of the right is different. And this alteration produced the most momentous consequences. In all the confederations which had been formed before the American Union, the federal government demanded its supplies at the hands of the separate governments. And if the measure it prescribed was onerous to any one of those bodies, means were found to evade its claims. If the state was powerful, it had recourse to arms. If it was weak, it connived at the resistance which the law of the Union, its sovereign, met with, and resorted to inaction under a plea of inability. Under these circumstances, one of the two alternatives has invariably occurred. Either the most preponderant of the allied peoples has assumed the privileges of the federal authority and ruled all the states in its name. Author's note, this was the case in Greece when Philip undertook to execute the decree of the Amphictyons. In the Low Countries, where the province of Holland always gave the law, and in our own time, in the Germanic Confederation, in which Austria and Prussia assume a great degree of influence over the whole country, in the name of the Diet. Or the federal government has been abandoned by its natural supporters, anarchy has arisen between the Confederates, and the Union has lost all powers of action. Author's note, such has always been the situation of the Swiss Confederation, which would have perished ages ago but for the mutual jealousies of its neighbors. In America, the subjects of the Union are not states, but private citizens. The national government levies a tax not upon the state of Massachusetts, but upon each inhabitant of Massachusetts. All former Confederate governments presided over communities, but that of the Union rules individuals. Its force is not borrowed, but self-derived. And it is served by its own civil and military officers, by its own army, and its own courts of justice. It cannot be doubted that the spirit of the nation, the passions of the multitude, and the provincial prejudices of each state tend singularly to diminish the authority of a federal authority thus constituted and to facilitate the means of resistance to its mandates. But the comparative weakness of a restricted sovereignty is an evil inherent in the federal system. In America, each state has fewer opportunities of resistance and fewer temptations to noncompliance. Nor can such a design be put in execution, if indeed it be entertained, without an open violation of the laws of the Union, a direct interruption of the ordinary course of justice, and a bold declaration of revolt. In a word, without taking a decisive step which men hesitate to adopt. In all former confederations, the privileges of the Union furnished more elements of discord than of power, since they multiplied the claims of the nation without augmenting the means of enforcing them. And in accordance with this fact, it may be remarked that the real weakness of federal governments has almost always been in the exact ratio of their nominal power. Such is not the case in the American Union, in which, as in ordinary governments, the federal government has the means of enforcing all it is empowered to demand. The human understanding more easily invents new things than new words, and we are thence constrained to employ a multitude of improper and inadequate expressions. When several nations form a permanent league and establish a supreme authority, which, although it is not the same influence over the members of the community as a national government, acts upon each of the Confederate states in a body, this government, which is so essentially different from all others, is denominated a federal one. Another form of society is afterwards discovered, in which several peoples are fused into one and the same nation with regard to certain common interests, although they remain distinct, or at least only confederate, with regard to all their other concerns. In this case, the central power acts directly upon those whom it governs, whom it rules, and whom it judges, in the same manner as, but in a more limited circle than, a national government. Here, the term federal government is clearly no longer applicable to a state of things which must be styled an incomplete national government. A form of government has been found out which is neither exactly national nor federal. But no further progress has been made, and the new word which will one day designate this novel invention does not yet exist. The absence of this new species of confederation has been the cause which has brought all unions to civil war, to subjection, or to a stagnant apathy. And the peoples which formed these leagues have been either too dull to discern or too pusillanimous to apply this great remedy. The American Federation perished by the same defects. But the Confederate States of America had been long accustomed to form a portion of one empire before they had won their independence. They had not contracted the habit of governing themselves, and their national prejudices had not taken deep root in their minds. Superior to the rest of the world in political knowledge, and sharing that knowledge equally amongst themselves, they were little agitated by the passions which generally oppose the extension of federal authority in a nation, and those passions were checked by the wisdom of the chief citizens. The Americans applied the remedy with prudent firmness. As soon as they were conscious of the evil, they amended their laws, and they saved their country. Advantages of the federal system in general and its special utility in America. In small nations, the scrutiny of society penetrates into every part, and the spirit of improvement enters into the most trifling details. As the ambition of the people is necessarily checked by its weakness, all the efforts and resources of the citizens are turned to the internal benefit of the community and are not likely to evaporate in the fleeting breath of glory. The desires of every individual are limited because extraordinary faculties are rarely to be met with. The gifts of an equal fortune render the various conditions of life uniform, and the manners of the inhabitants are orderly and simple. Thus, if one estimates the gradations of popular morality and enlightenment, we shall generally find that in small nations there are more persons in easy circumstances, a more numerous population, and a more tranquil state of society than in great empires. When tyranny is established in the bosom of a small nation, it is more galling than elsewhere, because, as it acts within a narrow circle, every point of that circle is subject to its direct influence. It supplies the place of those great designs which it cannot entertain by a violent or an exasperating interference in a multitude of minute details. And it leaves the political world, to which it properly belongs, to meddle with the arrangements of domestic life. Tastes as well as actions are to be regulated at its pleasure, and the families of the citizens as well as the affairs of the state are to be governed by its decisions. This invasion of rights occurs, however, but seldom, and freedom is in truth the natural state of small communities. The temptations which the government offers to ambition are too weak, and the resources of private individuals are too slender, for the sovereign power easily to fall within the grasp of a single citizen. And should such an event have occurred, the subjects of the state can without difficulty overthrow the tyrant and his oppression by a simultaneous effort. Small nations have therefore ever been the cradle of political liberty, and the fact that many of them have lost their immunities by extending their dominion shows that the freedom they enjoyed was more a consequence of their inferior size than of the character of the people. The history of the world affords no instance of a great nation retaining the form of republican government for a long series of years. I do not speak of a confederation of small republics, but of a great consolidated republic, and this has led to the conclusion that such a state of things is impracticable. For my own part, I cannot but censure the imprudence of attempting to limit the possible and to judge the future on the part of a being who is hourly deceived by the most palpable realities of life, and who is constantly taken by surprise in the circumstances with which he is most familiar. But it may be advanced with confidence that the existence of a great republic will always be exposed to far greater perils than that of a small one. All the passions which are most fatal to republican institutions spread with an increasing territory, whilst the virtues which maintain their dignity do not augment in the same proportion. The ambition of the citizens increases with the power of the state, the strength of parties with the importance of the ends they have in view. But that devotion to the common weal which is the surest check on destructive passions is not stronger in a large than in a small republic. It might indeed be proved without difficulty that it is less powerful and less sincere. The arrogance of wealth and the dejection of wretchedness, capital cities of unwonted extent, a lax morality, a vulgar egotism, and a great confusion of interests are the dangers which almost invariably arise from the magnitude of states. But several of these evils are scarcely prejudicial to a monarchy, and some of them contribute to maintain its existence. In monarchical states, the strength of the government is its own. It may use, but it does not depend on, the community, and the authority of the prince is proportioned to the prosperity of the nation. But the only security which a republican government possesses against these evils lies in the support of the majority. This support is not, however, proportionably greater in a large republic than it is in a small one. And thus, whilst the means of attack perpetually increase both in number and in influence, the power of resistance remains the same, or it may rather be said to diminish, since the propensities and interests of the people are diversified by the increase of the population, and the difficulty of forming a compact majority is constantly augmented. It has been observed, moreover, that the intensity of human passions is heightened, not only by the importance of the end which they propose to attain, but by the multitude of individuals who are animated by them at the same time. Everyone has had occasion to remark that his emotions in the midst of a sympathizing crowd are far greater than those which he would have felt in solitude. In great republics, the impetus of political passion is irresistible, not only because it aims at gigantic purposes, but because it is felt and shared by millions of men at the same time. It may therefore be asserted, as a general proposition, that nothing is more opposed to the well-being and the freedom of man than vast empires. Nevertheless, it is important to acknowledge the peculiar advantages of great states. For the very reason which renders the desire of power more intense in these communities than amongst ordinary men, the love of glory is also more prominent in the hearts of a class of citizens, who regard the applause of a great people as a reward worthy of their exertions, and an elevating encouragement to man. If we would learn why it is that great nations contribute more powerfully to the spread of human improvement than small states, we shall discover an adequate cause in the rapid and energetic circulation of ideas, and in those great cities which are the intellectual centers where all the rays of human genius are reflected and combined. To this, it may be added that most important discoveries demand a display of national power which the government of a small state is unable to make. In great nations, the government entertains a greater number of general notions and is more completely disengaged from the routine of precedent and the egotism of local prejudice. Its designs are conceived with more talent and executed with more boldness. In time of peace, the well-being of small nations is undoubtedly more general and more complete, but they are apt to suffer more acutely from the calamities of war than those great empires whose distant frontiers may for ages avert the presence of the danger from the mass of the people, which is therefore more frequently afflicted than ruined by the evil. But in this matter, as in many others, the argument derived from the necessity of the case predominates over all others. If none but small nations existed, I do not doubt that mankind would be more happy and more free, but the existence of great nations is unavoidable. This consideration introduces the element of physical strength as a condition of national prosperity. It profits a people but little to be affluent and free if it is perpetually exposed to be pillaged or subjugated. The number of its manufactures and the extent of its commerce are of small advantage if another nation has the empire of the seas and gives the law in all the markets of the globe. Small nations are often impoverished, not because they are small, but because they are weak. The great empires prosper less because they are great than because they are strong. Physical strength is therefore one of the first conditions of the happiness and even the existence of nations. Hence it occurs that, unless very peculiar circumstances intervene, small nations are always united to large empires in the end, either by force or by their own consent. Yet I am unacquainted with a more deplorable spectacle than that of a people unable either to defend or to maintain its independence. The federal system was created with the intention of combining the different advantages which result from the greater and the lesser extent of nations, and a single glance over the United States of America suffices to discover the advantages which they have derived from its adoption. In great centralized nations, the legislator is obliged to impart a character of uniformity to the laws, which does not always suit the diversity of customs and of districts. As he takes no cognizance of special cases, he can only proceed upon general principles, and the population is obliged to conform to the exigencies of the legislation, since the legislation cannot adapt itself to the exigencies and the customs of the population, which is the cause of endless trouble and misery. This disadvantage does not exist in confederations. Congress regulates the principal measures of the national government, and all the details of the administration are reserved to the provincial legislatures. It is impossible to imagine how much this division of sovereignty contributes to the well-being of each of the states which compose the Union. In these small communities, which are never agitated by the desire of aggrandizement or the cares of self-defense, all public authority and private energy is employed in internal amelioration. The central government of each state, which is in immediate juxtaposition to the citizens, is daily apprised of the wants which arise in society. And new projects are proposed every year, which are discussed either at town meetings or by the legislature of the state, and which are transmitted by the press to stimulate the zeal and to excite the interest of the citizens. This spirit of amelioration is constantly alive in the American republics, without compromising their tranquility. The ambition of power yields to the less refined and less dangerous love of comfort. It is generally believed in America that the existence and the permanence of the republican form of government in the New World depend upon the existence and the permanence of the federal system. And it is not unusual to attribute a large share of the misfortunes which have befallen the new states of South America to the injudicious erection of great republics instead of a divided and confederate sovereignty. It is incontestably true that the love and the habits of republican government in the United States were engendered in the townships and in the provincial assemblies. In a small state, like that of Connecticut, for instance, where cutting a canal or laying down a road is a momentous political question, where the state has no army to pay and no wars to carry on, and where much wealth and much honor cannot be bestowed upon the chief citizens, no form of government can be more natural or more appropriate than that of a republic. But it is this same republican spirit, it is these manners and customs of a free people, which are engendered and nurtured in the different states, to be afterwards applied to the country at large. The public spirit of the Union is, so to speak, nothing more than an abstract of the patriotic zeal of the provinces. Every citizen of the United States transfuses his attachment to his little republic in the common store of American patriotism. In defending the Union, he defends the increasing prosperity of his own district, the right of conducting its affairs, and the hope of causing measures of improvement to be adopted which may be favorable to his own interest. And these are motives which are wont to stir men more readily than the general interests of the country and the glory of the nation. On the other hand, if the temper and the manners of the inhabitants especially fitted them to promote the welfare of a great republic, the federal system smoothed the obstacles which they might have encountered. The confederation of all the American states presents none of the ordinary disadvantages resulting from great agglomerations of men. The Union is a great republic in extent, but the paucity of objects for which its government provides assimilates it to a small state. Its acts are important, but they are rare. As the sovereignty of the Union is limited and incomplete, its exercise is not incompatible with liberty, for it does not excite those insatiable desires of fame and power which have proved so fatal to great republics. As there is no common center to the country, vast capital cities, colossal wealth, abject poverty, and sudden revolutions are alike unknown. And political passion, instead of spreading over the land like a torrent of desolation, spends its strength against the interests and the individual passions of every state. Nevertheless, all commodities and ideas circulate throughout the Union as freely as in a country inhabited by one people. Nothing checks the spirit of enterprise. Government avails itself of all the assistance of all who have talents or knowledge to serve it. Within the frontiers of the Union, the profoundest peace prevails, as within the heart of some great empire. Abroad, it ranks with the most powerful nations of the earth. 2,000 miles of coast are open to the commerce of the world, and as it possesses the keys of the globe, its flag is respected in the most remote seas. The Union is as happy and as free as a small people, and as glorious and as strong as a great nation. Why the federal system is not adapted to all peoples, and how the Anglo-Americans were enabled to adopt it. When a legislator succeeds, after persevering efforts, in exercising an indirect influence upon the destiny of nations, his genius is lauded by mankind, whilst, in point of fact, the geographical position of the country which he is unable to change, a social condition which arose without his cooperation, manners and opinions which he cannot trace to their source, and an origin with which he is unacquainted, exercise so irresistible an influence over the courses of society that he is himself borne away by the current after an ineffectual resistance. Like the navigator, he may direct the vessel which bears him along, but he can neither change its structure nor raise the winds, nor lull the waters which swell beneath him. I have shown the advantages which the Americans derive from their federal system. It remains for me to point out the circumstances which rendered that system practicable, as its benefits are not to be enjoyed by all nations. The incidental defects of the federal system which originate in the laws may be corrected by the skill of the legislator, but there are further evils inherent in the system which cannot be counteracted by the peoples which adopt it. These nations must therefore find the strength necessary to support the natural imperfections of their government. The most prominent evil of all federal systems is the very complex nature of the means they employ. Two sovereignties are necessary in presence of each other. The legislator may simplify and equalize the action of these two sovereignties by limiting each of them to a sphere of authority accurately defined. But he cannot combine them into one or prevent them from coming into collision at certain points. The federal system, therefore, rests upon a theory which is necessarily complicated, and which demands the daily exercise of a considerable share of discretion on the part of those it governs. A proposition must be plain to be adopted by the understanding of a people. A false notion which is clear and precise will always meet with a greater number of adherents in the world than a true principle which is obscure or involved. Hence it arises that parties, which are like small communities in the heart of the nation, invariably adopt some principle or some name as a symbol, which very inadequately represents the end they have in view and the means which are at their disposal, but without which they could neither act nor subsist. The governments which are founded upon a single principle or a single feeling which is easily defined are perhaps not the best, but they are unquestionably the strongest and the most durable in the world. In examining the Constitution of the United States, which is the most perfect federal constitution that ever existed, one is startled, on the other hand, at the variety of information and the excellence of discretion which it presupposes in the people whom it is meant to govern. The government of the Union depends entirely upon legal fictions. The Union is an ideal nation which only exists in the mind, and whose limits and extent can only be discerned by the understanding. When once the general theory is comprehended, numberless difficulties remain to be solved in its application. For the sovereignty of the Union is so involved in that of the states that it is impossible to distinguish its boundaries at the first glance. The whole structure of the government is artificial and conventional, and it would be ill adapted to a people which has not been long accustomed to conduct its own affairs, or to one in which the science of politics has not descended to the humblest classes of society. I have never been more struck by the good sense and the practical judgment of the Americans than in the ingenious devices by which they elude the numberless difficulties resulting from their federal constitution. I scarcely ever met with a plain American citizen who could not distinguish, with surprising facility, the obligations created by the laws of Congress from those created by the laws of his own state, and who, after having discriminated between the matters which come under the cognizance of the Union and those which the local legislature is competent to regulate, could not point out the exact limit of the several jurisdictions of the federal courts and the tribunals of the state. The Constitution of the United States is like those exquisite productions of human industry which ensure wealth and renown to their inventors, but which are profitless in any other hands. This truth is exemplified by the condition of Mexico at the present time. The Mexicans were desirous of establishing a federal system, and they took the federal constitution of their neighbors, the Anglo-Americans, as their model, and copied it with considerable accuracy. But although they had borrowed the letter of the law, they were unable to create or to introduce the spirit and the sense which give it life. They were involved in ceaseless embarrassments between the mechanism of their double government. The sovereignty of the states and that of the Union perpetually exceeded their respective privileges and entered into collision. And to the present day, Mexico is alternately the victim of anarchy and the slave of military despotism. The second and the most fatal of all the defects I have alluded to, and that which I believe to be inherent in the federal system, is the relative weakness of the government of the Union. The principle upon which all confederations rest is that of a divided sovereignty. The legislator may render this partition less perceptible. He may even conceal it for a time from the public eye, but he cannot prevent it from existing, and a divided sovereignty must always be less powerful than an entire supremacy. The listener has heard in the remarks I have made on the Constitution of the United States that the Americans have displayed singular ingenuity in combining the restriction of the power of the Union within the narrow limits of a federal government with the semblance and, to a certain extent, with the force of a national government. By this means, the legislators of the Union have succeeded in diminishing, though not in counteracting, the natural danger of confederations. It has been remarked that the American government does not apply itself to the states, but that it immediately transmits its injunctions to the citizens and compels them as isolated individuals to comply with its demands. But if the federal law were to clash with the interests and the prejudices of a state, it might be feared that all the citizens of the state would conceive themselves to be interested in the cause of a single individual who should refuse to obey. If all the citizens of the state were aggrieved at the same time and in the same manner by the authority of the Union, the federal government would vainly attempt to subdue them individually. They would instinctively unite in a common defense, and they would derive a ready-prepared organization from the share of sovereignty which the institution of their state allows them to enjoy. Fiction would give way to reality, and an organized portion of the territory might then contest the central authority. The same observation holds good with regard to the federal jurisdiction. If the courts of the Union violated an important law of a state in a private case, the real, if not the apparent, contest would arise between the aggrieved state represented by a citizen and the Union represented by its courts of justice. Author's note: for instance, the Union possesses by the Constitution the right of selling unoccupied lands for its own profit. Supposing that the state of Ohio should claim the same right in behalf of certain territories lying within its boundaries, upon the plea that the Constitution refers to those lands alone which do not belong to the jurisdiction of any particular state, and consequently should choose to dispose of them itself, the litigation would be carried on in the names of the purchasers from the state of Ohio and the purchasers from the Union, and not in the names of Ohio and the Union. But what would become of this legal fiction if the federal purchaser was confirmed in his right by the courts of the Union, whilst the other competitor was ordered to retain possession by the tribunals of the state of Ohio? He would have but a partial knowledge of the world who should imagine that it is possible, by the aid of legal fictions, to prevent men from finding out and employing those means of gratifying their passions which have been left open to them. And it may be doubted whether the American legislators, when they rendered a collision between the two sovereigns less probable, destroyed the cause of such a misfortune. But it may even be affirmed that they were unable to ensure the preponderance of the federal element in a case of this kind. The Union is possessed of money and of troops, but the affections and the prejudices of the peoples are in the bosom of the states. The sovereignty of the Union is an abstract being, which is connected with but few external objects. The sovereignty of the states is hourly perceptible, easily understood, constantly active. And if the former is of recent creation, the latter is coeval with the people itself. The sovereignty of the Union is fictitious, that of the states, is natural and derives its existence from its own simple influence, like the authority of a parent. The supreme power of the nation only affects a few of the chief interests of society. It represents an immense but remote country and claims a feeling of patriotism which is vague and ill-defined. But the authority of the state controls every individual citizen at every hour and in all circumstances. It protects his property, his freedom, and his life. And when we recollect the traditions, the customs, the prejudices of local and familiar attachment with which it is connected, we cannot doubt the superiority of a power which is interwoven with every circumstance that renders the love of one's native country instinctive in the human heart. Since legislators are unable to obviate such dangerous collisions as occur between the two sovereignties which coexist in the federal system, their first object must be not only to dissuade the Confederate states from warfare, but to encourage such institutions as may promote the maintenance of peace. Hence it results that the federal compact cannot be lasting, unless there exists in the communities which are leagued together a certain number of inducements to union which render their common dependence agreeable, and the task of the government light, and that system cannot succeed without the presence of favorable circumstances added to the influence of good laws. All the peoples which have ever formed a confederation have been held together by a certain number of common interests, which served as the intellectual ties of association. But the sentiments and the principles of man must be taken into consideration as well as his immediate interests. A certain uniformity of civilization is not less necessary to the durability of a confederation than a uniformity of interests in the states which compose it. In Switzerland, the difference which exists between the canton of Uri and the canton of Vaud is equal to that between the 15th and the 19th centuries. And properly speaking, Switzerland has never possessed a federal government. The union between these two cantons only subsists upon the map, and their discrepancies would soon be perceived if an attempt were made by a central authority to prescribe the same laws to the whole territory. One of the circumstances which most powerfully contribute to support the federal government in America is that the states have not only similar interests, a common origin, and a common tongue, but that they are also arrived at the same stage of civilization, which almost always renders a union feasible. I do not know of any European nation, how small soever it may be, which does not present less uniformity in its different provinces than the American people, which occupies a territory as extensive as one half of Europe. The distance from the state of Maine to that of Georgia is reckoned at about 1,000 miles. But the difference between the civilization of Maine and that of Georgia is slighter than the difference between the habits of Normandy and those of Brittany. Maine and Georgia, which are placed at the opposite extremities of a great empire, are consequently in the natural possession of more real inducements to form a confederation than Normandy and Brittany, which are only separated by a bridge. The geographical position of the country contributed to increase the facilities which the American legislators derived from the manners and customs of the inhabitants, and it is to this circumstance that the adoption and the maintenance of the federal system are mainly attributable. The most important occurrence which can mark the annals of a people is the breaking out of a war. In war, a people struggles with the energy of a single man against foreign nations in the defense of its very existence. The skill of a government, the good sense of the community, and the natural fondness which men entertain for their country may suffice to maintain peace in the interior of a district and to favor its internal prosperity. But a nation can only carry on a great war at the cost of more numerous and more painful sacrifices. And to suppose that a great number of men will of their own accord comply with these exigencies of the state is to betray an ignorance of mankind. All the peoples which have been obliged to sustain a long and serious warfare have consequently been led to augment the power of their government. Those which have not succeeded in this attempt have been subjugated. A long war almost always places nations in the wretched alternative of being abandoned to ruin by defeat or to despotism by success. War, therefore, renders the symptoms of the weakness of a government most palpable and most alarming, and I have shown that the inherent defeat of federal governments is that of being weak. The federal system is not only deficient in every kind of centralized administration, but the central government itself is imperfectly organized, which is invariably an influential cause of inferiority when the nation is opposed to other countries which are themselves governed by a single authority. In the Federal Constitution of the United States, by which the central government possesses more real force, this evil is still extremely sensible. An example will illustrate the case to the reader. The Constitution confers upon Congress the right of calling forth militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. And another article declares that the President of the United States is the Commander-in-Chief of the militia. In the War of 1812, the President ordered the militia of the Northern States to march to the frontiers, but Connecticut and Massachusetts, whose interests were impaired by the war, refused to obey the command. They argued that the Constitution authorizes the federal government to call forth the militia in cases of insurrection or invasion, but that in the present instance there was neither invasion nor insurrection. They added that the same Constitution which conferred upon the Union the right of calling forth the militia reserved to the states that of naming the officers, and that consequently, as they understood the clause, no officer of the Union had any right to command the militia, even during war, except the President in person. And in this case, they were ordered to join an army commanded by another individual. These absurd and pernicious doctrines received the sanction not only of the governors and the legislative bodies, but also of the courts of justice in both states. And the federal government was constrained to raise elsewhere the troops which it required. Author's note: I have selected an example which relates to a time posterior to the promulgation of the present Constitution. If I had gone back to the days of the Confederation, I might have given still more striking instances. The whole nation was at that time in a state of enthusiastic excitement. The Revolution was represented by a man who was the idol of the people, but at that very period Congress had, to say the truth, no resources at all at its disposal. Troops and supplies were perpetually wanting. The best devised projects failed in the execution, and the Union, which was constantly on the verge of destruction, was saved by the weakness of its enemies far more than by its own strength. The only safeguard which the American Union, with all the relative perfection of its laws, possesses against the dissolution which would be produced by a great war, lies in its probable exemption from that calamity. Placed in the center of an immense continent, which offers a boundless field for human industry, the Union is almost as much insulated from the world as if its frontiers were girt by the ocean. Canada contains only 1 million of inhabitants, and its population is divided into 2 inimical nations. The rigor of the climate limits the extension of its territory and shuts up its ports during the 6 months of winter. From Canada to the Gulf of Mexico, a few savage tribes are to be met with, which retire, perishing in their retreat, before 6,000 soldiers. To the south, the Union has a point of contact with the Empire of Mexico, and it is thence that serious hostilities may one day be expected to arise. But for a long while to come, the uncivilized state of the Mexican community, the depravity of its morals, and its extreme poverty will prevent that country from ranking high amongst nations. As for the powers of Europe, they are too distant to be formidable. The great advantage of the United States does not, then, consist in the federal constitution which allows them to carry on great wars,